Forget whatever plans you have this weekend because you're staying at home and playing on SpinQuest. And there's never been a better time to sign up than right now. New users get $30 coin packs for just $10. All the table games you love with hundreds of slot games and real cash prizes. That's at SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, as you know, my main thesis on Brokenomics is that the system is broken, and the system is made up of people. So possibly some of the people are broken, leading to a system which is also broken. So I thought, who do I know who can talk about that sort of stuff? And that's when I turned to my favourite YouTube psychologist, Richard Grannan.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much for coming in. Wanted to have you in for a long time. So, tell us a little bit about yourself. What, why are you the man to speak to about the dark triad behaviour that is manifesting from our political and economic system?
Well, my background is in psychology. I am a psychology graduate, but it was a behavioural psychology degree. So we did nothing to do with personality disorders.
Right.
And then I spent a while
How is behavioural psychology different to basic psychology?
So if you wanted to, behavioural psychology, they're only really interested in that which can be seen or measured. It's behaviour only. So you'd put lots of rats in T-shaped mazes and try and incentivize them to go left or right. There's an awful lot of that. So I suppose you could say it's the side of psychology that tries to be a hard science.
Okay.
So it's very scientific.
Okay.
If I'd say measurable. It that way. Yeah, measurable. Now my interest is really Freud, Jung, Adler, psychoanalytic theory. And it's from that place that, largely speaking, the notion of personality disorders comes from. It's a largely Freudian concept, the idea of narcissism. And so over the years, when I was teaching self-defense, people started to ask me to teach about emotional self-defense. So I was already blending psychology with self-defense because I had a psychology background to teach people to be prepared for real-world violence. And then the instructors that I was speaking to, they would ask me questions. They would say, can I ask you about my wife? Or can I ask you about my kids? And then that grew into a project that was more focused on childhood trauma, PTSD, and then its manifestations in psychopathy and narcissistic personality disorder.
What forms did you focus on in your martial arts?
Started out with Shito Ryu Karate, moved to Spirit Combat Jiu-Jitsu, did Togakuri Ryu Ninjutsu for a few years, Aikido, Judo, shifted over to Muay Thai, then when MMA got big, well, we called it Valet Tudo or shoot fighting before the term MMA was born, so this is back in the 90s. Boxing, wrestling, Silat, I've done some Wing Chun, some Tai Chi, some Qigong. Lots. Are you into martial arts?
I've done about two-thirds of those.
Okay.
If you had to pick one, I would go with boxing, because even though it is the least sophisticated of all the ones you mentioned,
yeah,
it is so immediate.
Do you mean pick one for a brawl in the pub kind of a thing?
Well, I mean, if you lived in a rough area and you had a 13-year-old son who you were worried who had to look after himself.
Yes.
I think I'd go with boxing because it's just right there straight away. Whereas the other ones,
yes,
you know, you can get to a higher level, but the curve is a lot longer.
As I've aged, one of my favorite disciplines is now boxing. Because when I was younger, I didn't really think I did it because I had to do it. It's part of combat sports. And if you couldn't box, people think you're an idiot. But then the puzzle of boxing, because it's quite an interesting puzzle to try and solve, has become more fascinating to me. I actually have a TBI from boxing, so I can't hard spar anymore. I can only tap spar.
Okay.
Yeah. I split the bag around my brain sparring. But boxing I love. If I had a 13-year-old son, probably Muay Thai, just because of the clinching. So he'd have his hands and then he'd be able to clinch a knee. And sometimes, you know, I used to do nightclub security. If you kick someone in the leg, it doesn't look that bad on CCTV. The police don't mind.
Right.
But it could stop them. They could be like, because it's a shock. You go, oh,
I suppose that's Boxing Plus, isn't it?
So yeah, it's Boxing Plus. Boxing. So my favorite would be there's actually a style in Brazil. It's called shootbox. Vanderlei Silva came from it. So that was they sort of had the boxing format, and then they put on the elbows, the clinching, the knees, and the kicks for an MMA environment.
Did you ever do Krav Maga?
I've done a couple of classes. I've taught in Krav schools. So my main thing, I said self-defense, but you would know this, it was combatives. Mm. So they were our cousins. You know, the Krav guys would do drills like this. We would take from them, they would take from us. So yeah.
Krav did kind of change my psychology because I got quite into that. I mean, this was before COVID, I was going to go over to Israel because it's from Israel and spend a couple of weeks out there with those guys. But COVID, it never happened in the end. But I mean, Krav is just so brutal. I mean, it's just, you can't spar it. It's immediately eyes and throats and knees and stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah.
And as I started to learn it, I would find if it ever looked like I might be in a situation, I would be diffusing it because, I mean, more than I normally would, just because I didn't want to have to do that stuff if it came to it.
Yes, I mean, you could find yourself in a lot of legal trouble.
Yeah.
So the perfect thing for me now would be people who were athletic enough to survive combat sports. So they're scratch boxers, grapplers, they can wrestle, they can do their takedowns, nothing fancy, but you can cope. And then that would be 20% of the training, and 80% of the training, if it's for the street, would be combatives, so Krav style. But yes, when I was teaching it, eventually we split it. We said, here's what we do if somebody's broken into your house at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You're going to kill them or try to as quickly as you can. And then here's the control and restraint for if you just, I don't know, somebody's drunk at a party and you just need to put them on the floor.
Yeah.
And then we would drill that.
Yeah. I remember once one of my instructors, was teaching us all these forms. I think it was Taekwondo. And he pulled a few of us aside at one time and he said, look, all this stuff is great.
Mm.
If somebody's really trying to kill you,
don't
worry about any of this. Just get your thumb and drive it as far into the top of the eye socket as you can.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're really, really struggling. I have, unfortunately, used that a couple of times.
Hopefully you should never get to that point.
You should never. You've really messed up at multiple levels of redundancy to get to that point. But I'd put myself there. I was doing nightclub security in Tenerife. So I could find myself in situations of extreme pressure where you can end up being kicked to death. And that was where, in the combative style of thing, you would be looking at what causes the maximum amount of injury with the least amount of calories burnt on your behalf. You're right, you can't spar it. So we'd have to find drills where you could ingrain it into your physiology without hurting your training partners. I mean, because it's just stamp on somebody's knee and then hit them in the throat. Like you just can't do it. These are permanent injuries. So that was the style.
Right. We went slightly sideways.
We slightly did. But if boys are watching this, they'll love it. They'll be like, "That's great. That's all awesome."
But I do like this stuff. So I had to deviate onto that. So yes, the confluence of psychology and markets. It's not talked about that much, is it?
It's not, but I've had this suspicion for years and I've always thought, God, I'd love to bring... So I do get a chance to speak to professors of psychology and philosophy. Some of them are my mates, Professor Ed Dutton and Dr. Paul Taylor. Yeah. So if I have something, I can reach out to them. I think, God, I really need an economist. And the
that is not something you hear a lot.
No, it's not. God, I need an economist. Someone, please give me an economist.
I mean, when society collapses, I don't think the economists are going to have a particularly good time.
So the reason why is because obviously I love psychology, but I can see the limitations. It puts the problem in the individual, and it's very, very rare that if I'm depressed, that it's just purely my individual trauma, purely my individual genetics. It's a group.
Well, I mean, you must have seen those charts that show sort of societal level happiness.
Mm.
I mean, the women's one is the most extreme one. I mean, they've gone from basically being happy pre-war to incredibly unhappy. But I mean, it's happened to everybody.
So women are experiencing far higher levels of unhappiness than men.
Self-reported happiness. I mean, it's declined for everybody in the West, but women most especially.
That's very interesting, because I think they're more susceptible to the men, as a generalization, more susceptible than men to what's happening in the collective. So if the collective is unhappy.
Well, I suppose that also, and the fact that, I mean, we must be a similar age, but the messaging that I remember being put out to women when we were young was very much, if you are a stay-at-home mum, that means you're a failure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you must get out there into the workforce and strap yourself into an office chair.
Yes.
And spend the next 30 years there.
Otherwise, you're a waster.
Yeah,
and you failed the sisterhood.
Exactly. And I kind of just internalized this because it was the universal messaging.
Mm.
And we didn't have YouTube back in those days. We just had, you know, the message that came through media and schools and all the rest of it. And so I believed it myself. And then I noticed as I went through my career, the women just started dropping off.
Yeah.
And I'd be kind of surprised and say, why are you doing this?
Mm.
You've got a great job.
Mm.
And it was like, yeah, but I don't want to do this. It doesn't make me happy. The moment they have a kid, they're just off.
Yes.
They don't want to come back.
Yes. It's interesting. As far back as 2015, I was in Malaysia, which is a majority, well, it's a Muslim country, Muslim government. And one of my friends, we met in a shopping mall and she was very upset and she was crying. We'd had a long conversation and she started crying. And I said, what is it? And she said, all I want is to be a mother and have children. I said, you're a 28-year-old Muslim girl in a Muslim country. Of course you can do that. She said, I can't. My mother's a lecturer in feminism. And I was like, this poison, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And yeah.
I mean, but from my point of view, Islam has a limited number of appeal points, but its total repudiation of feminism is definitely one of them.
Well, and if they can't hold it back, I would just say who's got the strongest ideology?
Yeah.
Because what I would say, so I lived in the East for maybe a total of four years, Thailand, mainly in Malaysia. And I would come back and people would say things like, oh, in the West, it's like this. And in the East, it's like that. And I would say, no, the East is the West. If they have Wi-Fi, Instagram, and they know who the Kardashians are, they're in the West. They're in the West. And they go, well, but it's a Muslim country. And I'm like, what do you think is happening in Muslim countries in the Middle East to the Far East? It's all going this way. The predominant ideology, and it's back to economics again, is really downstream of capitalism. It's consumer capitalism.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, to build on your point there, I think what's happened is, so I talked about the happiness levels.
Yeah.
If you go back pre-war, and there were surveys done at the time that asked people, you know, what is your highest ideals in life?
Mm-hmm.
And making money was very low down the list.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the surveys I've seen, they gave you the top 10. And making money was on the list, but it was like 9th or 10th, right down the bottom. And at the top, it was things like basically live a rewarding life, garner respect in my community. It was all community orientated goals were right at the top, and money was at the bottom.
Mm.
And if you look at it, those same surveys today, it's flipped the other way around. Now it's, you know, being a upstanding member of your community. I don't think it even makes the top 10 anymore. If it is, it's right at the bottom, and making money has gone right to the top.
That's really interesting and really depressing. And if you could send me some of these to look at afterwards, I'd be really grateful. So this is where I really need an economist phrase kicks in. I've got a grasp of psychology. Hmm. I can bluff my way in philosophy, but then I just have this strong sense that what's happening psychologically, philosophically, meaning people's worldview, just the world, the way they see the world, the philosophy at that level, like a moral code, is influenced by factors that we're not talking about. So, so what's on stage is childhood trauma and microaggressions and issues around identity politics. That's on stage right now. Okay, fine. And then I look and I go, but so the microaggressions, the woke, the identity politics, I'm like, isn't that fundamentally economic? Because you have to be quite wealthy. You have to have quite a lot of disposable wealth to be wringing your hands.
The whole luxury belief things.
It's a luxury belief thing, isn't it?
Well, let me build out that point about the change in economics behaviour sort of pre-war and post-war.
Yeah.
I think I can explain that. A lot of the economics stuff drives essentially from demographic change is a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I don't just mean people. Well, the demographic change that came from immigration is a later effect, but basically the size of populations is a huge factor in this.
Yes,
I'll explain what I mean by that. The other one is the introduction of the fiat money system post-war, which turned money from being something scarce to money being something which was abundant. And when money becomes abundant, everything else becomes scarce.
I thought we were fiat before the Second World War.
Well, yeah. So I think in 1913, 15, something like that, the mm-hmm. UK came off the gold standard.
Okay.
I mean, it'd done this a couple of times. It came off and then went back on again.
Mm.
But in the early days, it was a fairly muted effect and the dollar was still on the gold standard.
Mm.
And since the dollar was the dominant currency, that kind of set the tone of things.
Mm-hmm.
Post-war, I mean, what happened in the war is all the gold ended up going to America.
Okay.
Partly as a function of the fact that everybody else was fighting a massive war and they were still producing stuff that we needed. So they earned it. But also people just sent it there for safekeeping because, you know, if you're France and you think things might get a bit dicey, the first thing you do is you send all your gold over to America, where it's comfortably out of the way. We got to the end of the war and somebody, probably an American, thought, maybe we should hang on to this.
Mm.
And so they needed to come up with a justification why they needed to hang on to all of the gold.
Right.
And the explanation given was, okay, well, we've got a large, powerful navy now.
Mm.
What we will do is we will hold on to the gold. We will protect international shipping. So the whole rationale for all of this is protecting international shipping and trade and stuff. The dollar can be the global currency and the dollar will be pegged to gold.
So is this the beginning of the Team America World Police scenario?
Yes.
I found out when I was living in Asia, the Asian security and the prevention of war is an American mission.
There's naval bases all over Asia.
And if we pulled them out, it was like, China would just take everything. I was like, I had no idea.
Yeah.
I literally no idea at all. So that comes from the opportunity they saw post-World War to move people to a fiat currency.
If you've got a whole bunch of gold, you've got most of the world's gold, you don't want to give it back.
Sure.
And they didn't.
Sure.
So we then went on this, the dollar became the global currency system, pegged to gold. And that works perfectly fine, pegging to gold, as long as you behave like you're pegged to gold.
Okay.
Which basically means you don't spend more than you earn.
Right. Because there's only so much in the vault.
Yes. First thing they did, started spending more than they earned. So that was a problem. And so they kept on creating new dollars because they were spending more than they earned and they needed to make up the difference.
Yep. Fiat currency.
Money which is backed by the promises of politicians.
Sounds like a great what could go wrong?
Exactly.
What could possibly go wrong?
So they started spending more, and so they created more dollars in order to finance the spending.
Mm.
And then people started to get a tiny bit suspicious that the dollar was not, in fact, backed by gold in the way that they said it was. And it was the French who went first. The French said, I think you guys are flagging it. We take our gold back. Mm. So they started their gold back. And of course, once one country does it, everybody's like, okay, there's an issue here. Mm. And Nixon in 72 or 73? I think it was 73. He basically realized that he had no choice apart from unpegging it and making the dollar a purely paper fiat system.
Right.
The morning after he did that surprise announcement, markets absolutely shot up.
Okay.
Which might seem counterintuitive, but the reason they did that is because stocks are things divided by pieces of paper.
Mm.
And the president has just said, I'm removing the only cap on the amount of pieces of paper that I can generate.
Right.
So therefore, everything which is a thing now needs to get redenominated by a larger number.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the unit denomination of these things has to go up.
Right.
And that created a system where, basically the amount of money would expand. The mechanism.
Yeah.
I'll just finish this. Because
yes. Yeah.
I roll out the whole mechanism. The mechanism of that is you take on debt.
Mm.
So you take on debt, which creates more money.
Mm.
But if you start creating debt in order to create more money, Well, you've got a problem then, because debt comes with interest.
Mm.
So even if you pay off the loan, well, where does the interest come from?
Mm.
That money does not exist in the world.
Mm.
So therefore, how do you pay off interest? Well, you create more debt. So the amount of debt must always expand. The amount of money must always expand.
Yes.
And you get in a situation where you get this continual growing bubble.
Yes.
And what that basically means is you put that on a compound, right? Mm. And what you find is that money becomes increasingly abundant.
Mm.
Whereas pre-war, money was relatively scarce, but things were abundant.
Mm.
And things were competing to get the money.
Mm.
But in that system, it's a lot easier. I mean, well, you know what it was like, speaking of your grandparents. You know, they would go out at 14, get an electrical apprenticeship, and on the way back from securing that, they would go and buy a house and get married and, yeah, and all the rest of it. Whereas, yeah, these days, you can be a 37-year-old lawyer and really struggling to get your first house.
Yes.
Because money has become so abundant that it doesn't really have that much value anymore,
mm,
whereas things do.
Mm.
So people have had to shift into basically a scarcity mindset, which means they desperately need to accumulate more and more of this melting ice cube,
right,
which is fiat money. So that I think is driving the phenomenon that you talked about just before I got into all of this,
mm,
which is that people have to do this.
Okay, scarcity mindset. I definitely need to ask you more about that. Was there ever a chance, say we go back to 1972, and Nixon is having a conversation with, I don't know, 8 people who are advising him. Was there ever a chance that this wouldn't completely ruin the system? Was there any way that it wouldn't, that he wasn't signing? It's a death certificate, right? There's no way out of that.
Yeah, well, as long as you keep the game going, it works.
So, okay, so if you were to say to me, what do the policies look like of the UK, of USA, of the modern Western liberal democratic countries, so-called, as far as the long-term plan goes? And I've always thought, I don't think there is a long-term plan. I think, yes, they're kicking a can down the road and just, yeah, praying that the next person who comes into power deals with it.
Oh, it's very much that, yeah. So, I mean, in answer to the point, was it obvious immediately that this was going to lead to ruin?
Mm.
Yes, it was. And a whole... And
they knew straight away. There was no surprise.
Yeah. And there was a whole bunch of people who understood it and immediately packed up for the hills. They loaded up the Americans call it, station wagons or whatever,
yeah,
it is. They,
yeah,
loaded up their station wagon with tins of beans, shotguns,
right,
and drove off into the woods
waiting for the collapse. Yeah.
Now, that was in like the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And they're still waiting.
Yeah.
So it is, in fact, I also had this the other day. I mean, James Dellingpole got in touch with me because he was a bit worried. Because his son's going to university and he's apparently sharing a dorm with some guy who's doing finance and is very, very good on the math stuff.
Mm.
And he started crunching the numbers. And he was like, this system is going to collapse. There's mathematically no other solution than this thing going to collapse. And James was asking me about it. And I was like, yeah, that is the case. But it's been the case since the mid-1970s.
So we are...
It's a mathematical certainty that it will collapse.
But we're just doing it in slow motion.
But as long as you can keep the plates spinning and you can keep adding more plates.
Mm.
So if you ever go to Cirque du Soleil or something, mm-hmm, and they do the plate spinning, mm, they're incredibly good at it. And you sit there as the audience member thinking, oh, they're definitely going to drop one in a minute. And they just get another plate and they get another plate and they keep doing it. But it is a mathematical certainty that if they didn't at some point stop that and move on to the next act of, you know, trapeziums or whatever the hell it was, that one person would not be able to grow forever with the amount of plates that they could spin. I mean, at some point there would just be hundreds of them and they couldn't possibly do it.
Yes.
That's the financial system that we're in.
And it's, well, I suppose at some level it's physics, isn't it? It has to have a limitation. It has to have a point, yes, at which it just bursts. So then, I don't want to digress too far, but it just occurred to me, if you're running a system politically and you can see, you're voted into power tomorrow and they take you into a room. Let's imagine where it's like the room out here that controls what's happening here. You can see in real time the numbers moving and you have your hands physically on levers of power that don't exist, but in this metaphor they do. I wonder what that does to people's their commitment to the job. Is this why we have so much political degeneracy? Because they know we ain't going anywhere. It can't last. I wonder if that creates this sort of nihilism.
Well, I mean, you can pick up a lot of this from interviews with politicians post being in office. Because we've all noticed that politicians talk a good game before they're elected. And the moment they become elected, all of a sudden, they just do exactly what the last guy did.
Right.
And, I mean, a whole bunch of them talked about this, but I'm thinking of George Osborne in this respect, that he came in and he was like, he wanted to cut government because he ideologically believed in cutting government and all the right things and all that kind of stuff. And he's talked about how he was basically, well, exactly what you said, which was taken aside and said, yeah, but if you do that, this will happen.
Right.
And if we were to reset the system, long term, it would be enormously beneficial.
Yes.
Short term, it would be a bloody disaster. Politicians are elected for the short term and not the long term.
Yes. Then don't we need a violent revolution and 10 years of dictatorship for the transition?
Well.
But it would need to be global, wouldn't it?
That could work. This is part of the reason why I've come around so much on Bitcoin. Because regardless of whether it's Bitcoin or whether it's something else, it could be gold for this purpose. If you're going to replace one financial system, you're going to need to have another one waiting in the wings.
Sure.
Because if you were to, I mean, go back to 2008, gold had been demonetized effectively. It was a store of value, but not much. It wasn't money. And gold is really difficult to use as money in a modern world because you've got to put it on a boat and ship it. Or you do what they used to do, which is you have it in a vault under the Bank of England.
Okay.
And what happens is when China trades with India, messages go back, and then every so often somebody wheels out a pallet of gold from the Chinese vault and puts it in the Indian vault.
Okay.
Right. The logic of gold is you have to centralize.
Right.
In order to have a global system to make it all work.
Yes.
Okay, the problem with that is in this modern world, is China, India, Russia, etc. going to be perfectly happy for all their gold to be sat in a vault below the Bank of England so that they can do their international trade? I would suspect not.
No.
So are you going to let every single central bank hold their own gold, which they will insist on doing? Okay, fine. What's the problem then? Do you trust them?
Yeah.
When the Chinese say, I would like to order, whatever it is, a quadrillion tons of steel, I'm good for it, I've got the gold, are you going to go, okay, well, I guess they say they've got it.
No reason to disbelieve them.
So that's why I've come around so much on Bitcoin. But one of the notions with that is that everybody is using fiat currency. More and more people are using Bitcoin. At some point, they will cross, and you can step off from one elevator to the other, and then one can plunge into the sea, and the other one can go up. What that will mean is that all the people who refuse to get off one system are just going to lose everything.
Right.
But at least you have an alternative, so you can save perhaps half or the majority or whatever number it is at that point.
What I said before about the country going into a dictatorship for the transition, in a global economy, obviously that wouldn't do much. You really need the globe to commit. Every country across the globe needs to commit to it, right?
Potentially. I mean, we kind of see an example of this with BRICS at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, Russia has been de-dollarized.
Yeah.
And the traditional, most other economists would look at that and say, well, look, it's a disaster for Russia because their GDP is declining, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, when you measure it in dollars, it is. When you measure it in industrial output, energy produced, agricultural output, if you measure it in the way that we used to measure economies, actually BRICS is doing... In fact, if you look at BRICS... I mean, they've got the majority of the world's commodities, energy, agriculture output, and population. The only thing they don't have at the moment is the majority of the innovation that's still taking place in America.
Sure.
If they were to ever get, and it would be harder for them because of their culturally, it's harder for them to innovate. They tend to be a lot more hierarchical on this stuff. If they could ever get that, sanctioning them would be, it's already absurd because they've got the majority of all of these things that I mentioned, which is very difficult. And actually, the other thing I'll make up the point on, with growth of the system is that it's it's worse for countries like the US and the UK. I'll explain why.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about it, then America has the global system. And what is their main export now? Their main export is actually their debt.
Mm.
And how
is debt exported?
Right. Well, because everybody needs, because if we're on a dollar based system.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Everybody needs dollars. If you're Sri Lanka and you want to buy diesel, you need dollars to trade internationally to buy diesel, and that is exactly why Sri Lanka collapsed. What it was 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago.
Mm.
The reason they collapsed is because they ran out of dollars.
Okay.
Which meant they couldn't buy diesel.
Mm.
Which meant that their farmers couldn't put diesel in the tractors. It meant their delivery drivers couldn't put diesel in their delivery vans.
Mm.
And so the economy collapsed and the government collapsed. And you saw those scenes of the president's limo collection getting tossed into the river by furious locals who were basically watching their kids go hungry.
Yeah.
Because of that. So the US has found that there was this insatiable demand for dollars, which it supplies via debt. So what does that do to them? Well, what it means is that they've got to create debt and then send it abroad. And in exchange, people will send them stuff. So it's I'm trading a concept, which is this debt notion, backed by the promises of politicians, for actual things. People are sending them actual stuff in exchange for this notion.
Yes, it's a bit like a branding sort of a thing, isn't it? You'll spend an awful lot of money on Versace, but it's still a handbag that you could get from Zara. It's purely psychological.
But what that means is that they kind of have to send all their manufacturing abroad.
Yeah.
Because if you're getting stuff from abroad and you're sending things out, well, you want to get all the things want to be outside.
Yes.
And all the debt wants to be inside going outwards so that finished goods and raw materials then sort of flow back inwards. So once you're on that system, you know, you're kind of very locked into it. Because if you're going to change it, I mean, you've already spent the last 30 years deindustrializing your own country and sending all of that abroad. If you just stop it like that, well, why is anyone going to send you anything? They're not.
There's no incentive.
You've completely deindustrialized yourself. So in order to build back up again, now long term, America will be fine because America has... It's got the best starting. Obviously, it's got the best starting position in the game of civilizations.
Mm.
It's got abundant, good agricultural land. It's got a decent amount of commodities. It's got lots of energy. It's got a bright, motivated population. So long term, it will be fine.
Mm.
But can you imagine that sort of 20, 30 year transition from we don't need to do anything, people will just send us stuff, to oh look, we turned it off, nobody is sending us anything. And we can't produce anything.
You would need a dictatorship to survive. Because how else are people going to eat? You basically have to send out texts to people and go, "You're on the farm today, and so are your children." please attend the local centre and sign in.
And the UK is in a similar position to that because we can do a bit of that in producing debt and sending it to other people because UK debt is still worth something, but it's not the dollar.
Mm.
So the way that we got around it was, okay, well, we're going to have a massive financial services sector.
Mm.
So we're going to plug into this dollar system and
I've heard this before, and that's what makes London, London, or did make London, London. It's so fucking devious, but you have to respect it. They got a piece of the action.
Yeah.
And, well, they're basically middlemen.
They're the bagman. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yes.
They're producing nothing. They're just like, well, we have some nice hotels for you to chat to each other in whilst you do these things.
Yeah, if you want to trade in the European time zone, well, Europe, Africa, Middle East, well, come to London because we're in the right time zone. We speak English.
Mm.
We can culturally relate to you. So you can send your American bankers over, or you don't even need to do that. We train our own people. Mm. You just let us filter the dollar system through us.
Mm.
And that's how we survive. So if that system were to ever go away, well, Britain would be screwed as well.
Right.
Especially since we are aggressively shutting down our own agricultural, energy and manufacturing capabilities.
Why are we doing that?
Yes, that's a good question.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Hey,
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.